Okay, here we go.
Okay, here we go. Welcome once again. It is time for another episode of the Something Something Cast.
Something Something Cast.
I'm James Hatton.
I'm Podcast Rob.
And we are counting down to the end of year for the somethings.
Yeah, we are. Well, end of, 2016.
Yeah. Getting there. I mean, we have this episode, and I believe we have one more before we're all said and done.
We're usually so far ahead of the game now. Let me see. We're recording this on Friday, November 18th. The 22nd is going to be a Patreon episode. Am I correct?
That sounds correct to me. Yes, it is. So this goes up 29th.
So on the 29th, this is actually going to post. And then we typically only do one in December because of the holidays and everything. So
yeah,
my guess is this will go up on December 13th, and then we'll just have a decent stretch to the end of the holidays.
Yep. So first off, we got one more to go, but just wanted to say thank you, guys. I know we'll do our sort of end of year kebab next episode, but the Patreon is still going. We want you guys to sign up to that because we're still giving you stuff every week. You'll still get that till the end of the year. We have this radio drama. We give you the first episode of the space adventure last week.
Every other week.
2 weeks ago?
Every other week.
No, I know that. I'm saying we gave the listeners, the ones that hear this.
Yes.
The first episode of the space adventure.
Yes.
2 weeks ago, and I hope you guys enjoyed it. There's four more episodes. That's ending right before the end of the year. And we want you to know there's another adventure that Podcast Rob has written. That we've recorded the most of already. I've started editing it, and we have other stuff planned. So please go sign up to the patreon.com/somethingsomethingcast. It's $3, which is, as Tim Stevens said, three times the value.
Yes.
A deal at three times the cost, I should say.
We're still only going to do two Patreon episodes in December. So there'll be two Patreon episodes in December, one actual podcast episode in December. And then we pick everything back up again in January.
Yupper.
The new one that we are hip deep in so far. I don't even know if we're halfway to the end, like what we've written.
Are
we're
you serious?
Already longer than the current Patreon one, and it's kind of taking on a life of its own.
Yeah,
and,
you came in with
once you hear it and hear the subject matter. Maybe that'll explain a few things. Maybe not. I don't know.
Because you came in and we did, what, 3-4 episodes and we recorded those? And I was like, why are we doing 4 if we're only going to do 5 episodes of this thing? Oh, it just keeps going. Oh, neat.
Yeah,
okay.
No, we recorded like almost 6 episodes.
Okay. They're short, so I never sort of...
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, also, let's see. You were on a couple episodes of Things. Why don't you tell people?
Yes, I was on the spoiler cast episode for pre-recorded live. Got to hang out with Becky and Matt. That was always a good time.
You guys spoilered Doctor Strange?
Yes.
I still haven't seen it.
Oh, you're terrible.
I'm probably going to go after this show, like literally within hours after we finish recording this. I'm just going to go and watch it in 3D and sit alone and eat popcorn like a goon and just...
Oh, if you're going in 3D,
yes.
My note to you, when you get your popcorn bucket, ask for a second empty one.
Ah, okay, lot of speed motion.
Well, we did not see it in 3D. We went and saw it in regular 2D. But there were scenes that I was watching going, man, if we saw this in 3D, there might be some issues.
Because I love 3D, and I've never really had nausea issues with movies. So I'd hope, but hey, there's always a first time.
And I mean, if people are listening to this, you know, chime in on the Facebook, on the Twitter, on the website. It's a scene that everybody's seen already in the commercials and the trailers.
Okay.
It's the scene where Caecilius is standing on the very intricately carved two-tone parquet wood floor, and he's looking up at the ceiling, and the camera angle is looking down at him as the floor starts shifting, kaleidoscoping, swirling, whirlpooling kind of thing.
Oh, the Inception sort of look to it.
Yeah, but it's just that multicolored, you know, like pine and mahogany kind of parquet wood floor when it starts... I described it as vomiting up upon itself. Like, watching that in 2D, I was like, wow, that's really trip. Holy fuck, I don't want to know what this would have been like in 3D. Like, that's the one main scene. There's a lot of other things that I'm sure were amazingly awesome and probably had people near falling out of their chairs. You know, when shit starts going sideways in 3D, sometimes I kind of, like, lean with the scene as it's going. And then you're like, oh, fuck, jeez. Sorry, ma'am. I didn't realize I was, like, you know, laying across your legs. You're just following as things are going. But that one scene in particular, I was like, oh, that's kind of...
I'll let you know. I'll let you know what I
think.
Yeah,
it was... I thought it was a great movie, though. Fantastic.
And on promotional for me, the past 2 weeks have been pretty big for reallyshameless.com for all your vinyl decal needs. Not getting too political, I will stay away from that, but there is a category that I've put up called Love is Love. And $1 from each of the sale of those decals goes to the Trevor Project, which is a great outreach and suicide prevention for LGBT youth. So I just wanted to make a throw that out there, reallyshameless.com.
There you go. We also have a t-shirt site.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yes.
If you go to tpublic.com and in the search bar, one word, type something something cast, it pulls up a variety of different t-shirts that are available to help support our show. And there will be more designs coming up. We have a couple other ones that I hadn't sent Hatton for him to do his artistic mojo to clean up on yet. But there are going to be a couple other ones that we're going to be putting up. I would say hopefully by the end of November. But right now we have a very nice selection of Something Cast t-shirts. You can get your Something swag on and help support the show.
I need to get one of those NWO shows.
Yeah, they look pretty cool.
I love that one.
Yep.
Do you realize we finally become those guys? Like, we've done 5 minutes of show and we haven't discussed the topic. We barely segued to other stuff. We just promoted ourselves. That's amazing. We've hit the big time.
Okay.
I'm impressed that we have this much to say that has nothing to do with the actual episode.
Have you not ever listened to any of our podcasts in the past, dude?
This was just a lot of like, hey, what have you done the last 2 weeks? We've done a lot in the last 2 weeks.
Literally, we've done 3.5 years of not getting to the actual topic of our podcast for like the first 15, 20 minutes.
But
listeners can attest to this.
But that's normally... That's normally because we're sitting there like, so I had waffles this morning. Man, I really love waffles. I had pancakes. Like, this was like, holy shit, I did a bunch of podcasts. I did a bunch of vinyl. We got t-shirts. We got Patreon. We got all this stuff. We're hip hoppity. Like, this was.
So you're saying we stayed focused, is what you're saying.
Fair enough. And we remembered to mention all the shit we never remembered to mention.
Gotcha.
So, today's episode.
It is. Today's episode. It's an interesting one because for an audio show, it's amazingly visual.
Yeah, that we do these occasionally. We try and break up the comedy, the music, movies, TV. Since we've been on that media for a little bit again, we decided to go visual. Although, that being said, our Bad Movie Posters episode is a fan favorite, so maybe this one will reach too.
Very cool. The topic of this week's episode is James and I sat down and figured out our top 10 favorite comic book covers.
Yeah, this one I had a hard time with because just, and I'm sure you did too, with just how many comic covers come out in a week?
A lot, and truth be told, I haven't collected comics in a very fair amount of time. And we didn't do iconic, although I'm sure some of ours will fall into that.
Yeah.
We didn't, you know, we didn't do like, you know, Google's top 10 comic book covers of all time. These are comic book covers that were personal favorites of ours for one reason or another. And it's funny because I don't know about you, but when I was going through my list, I equate comic book issues with their covers.
I had that too.
So I would go, oh, this was an awesome issue. And then you pull up the cover for it and you're like, eh. Like, the issue was great, but I don't know that I can put the cover on like a top 10 of my all-time favorite. So then you end up with a list of like, you know, 34 comic books and you got to start just pairing them off one by one.
Yeah, I had a bunch. There was three or four that I knew immediately because they are literally like, I don't even, there's one or two I've never even read the issue. I just love the cover so much that I was like, that's on my list. And then there was one or two series. In my honorable mentions, there's one specific storyline that has tie together comics. I couldn't pick one. I didn't want to put the whole series on there. But individually, not as great. Together, phenomenal.
Gotcha.
So I had to start like going, all right, I really love this one for this reason. That takes this one out, which is a classic that is obviously good. Especially with my sort of birth of knowledge of X-Men knowledge. It was so hard for me to not just put 5 to 10 X-Men comics on there. I think I ended up with 2.
Right.
So yeah, this was harrowing, and I went with things that just the covers that really really meant something to me.
Yeah.
So rough. Where you want to start?
You can kick us off.
Fair enough. Mine are in no particular order, if only because it was so hard to figure them out and then to try and go, well, this one's better than this one because of this. And then it was just a royal pain in the ass. So I will start in no particular order with one of my Uncanny X-Men's. I'm going with Uncanny X-Men number 251. Super iconic image, super iconic cover. It's during the, right after the Mutant Massacre.
Okay.
It is, let me see here. I took notes and everything. It's a Dan Green cover. It features Wolverine crucified on an X. And it's got a vulture circling above him. There's clouds below that are sort of iconic of skulls. But it's done. The X-Men covers this time period, a lot of them are done in this real, like, subdued hue. And this is just in greens, purples, and blacks. And it's, for as much as I'm not a big Wolverine guy, him being crucified on an X speaks volumes about what goes on in that issue. And it's super fantastic. I do love that issue. But yeah, this was 99% sure this happened right after the Mutant Massacre. Donald Pierce, Wolverine's captor. Okay, yeah, and he's shocking, and this is Wolverine's having the shit kicked out of him for the entire issue.
What was the number again?
251.
251.
Yes, Uncanny X-Men.
I'm pulling it up as you're talking about it so I can get a look at it.
Understood.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeesh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, how gorgeous of a... Like, that just tells you, this is an episode where Wolverine sees some shit.
Yeah. Yeah, this is... yeah, this... Just... yeah, it's very purples and greens, and it's very... Huh.
Yeah, and it's a very Jubilee Wolverine-centric issue. This is when their friendship relationship thing was starting, the father-daughter sort of relationship.
Right.
And it's just a gorgeous issue cover. That's my first one. That's where I think I got it. The light that comes off the X on the side is just so gorgeous. There's nothing. If I was to look at this, I would have guessed it was a John Byrne cover, whom I have on my list a couple times.
Yeah.
But I was surprised it's Dan Green. So there you go.
Very cool. All right. So, yes, again, mine are also in no particular order. I went with Batman The Dark Knight Falls, number 3.
Dark Knight Falls. Please tell me the title.
It's the Frank Miller, you know, Dark Knight Returns.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the one that everybody thinks of, the giant lightning bolt with the silhouette of Batman mid-jump.
Right.
This is the standing on the trash pile, there's the silhouette of Superman and the silhouette of Batman in the giant powered bat armor, holding the sword and the, you know, what looks like a chain gun. With, you're not sure what the lighting behind it is. It could be dusk, it could be dawn, it could be a giant garbage fire.
Oh, that red, is the red yellow one?
It's the white, orange, yellow, red kind of background. And I went with this one. I love this series, obviously, and the first comic book is iconic. I can't tell you how many times I've reproduced that comic book cover on the back of denim jackets, on the legs of jeans, on notebooks. It's a great image, but this one to me spoke a little bit more because, in my opinion, you really don't know. It could mean so many things because you don't know what the lighting in the background is from.
Yeah.
Is it, you know, if it's dusk, then seeing these two iconic superheroes on the front of it, it gives you the feeling that, you know, somebody's not walking out of here.
Mm-hmm.
If it's dawn coming up and the sun is rising, then you get the opinion that, hey, whatever happens out of this, it's going to be for the better. If it's the garbage fire thing, you're thinking, you know what? Nobody wins, regardless of what the result of this is. It's just a complete and utter pig fuck. But it's just all the covers in general, because they've got just the silhouettes of the characters.
Yeah, Miller loves the silhouettes.
Yeah, in this one, the only thing you've got the Batman eyes, and you've got Superman's belt and his logo, but the rest of Superman is all just a black silhouette that blends in with whatever they're standing on, be it rubble or garbage pile or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a great comic cover.
What's funny is that I was just going through and I was looking at it, and I was looking at a different one. It seems that I found a different variation of that.
Okay.
Where it's the S is lit, Superman's belt, and then it's Batman's eyes. Unless that's what you meant and you said it backwards.
Yeah, no, that's what I said. Batman's eyes, and then Superman's belt and logo.
I thought you said it. I heard it backwards. My oral dyslexia is showing.
Okay.
You know what's interesting about this? Supes's cape sort of disappears into the background. Like, it's almost the exact same color red.
It does. It does bleed in.
But it gives it the perfect opportunity to see the Frank Miller loves drawing that little curly Q.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you get to see the little extra S right there. Yeah, this looks like it's honestly, if you were to show me this and say what happens next, I would say Superman just landed and Batman just unloads.
Yeah, it's just a great. I love the color composition. I love the tone of it.
And it only uses half the space, which I always like. I like subdued, and you'll see that in some of my others. That it uses that black space on the bottom to make it very movie and epic.
Yep, very cool.
Very cool. I dig it. I'm going to go with one of my John Burns. It's probably the first comic cover I ever saw that made me look at comic covers and go, they don't have to just be the hero posing or you know, some big action sequence or the villain is going to be. And it's Alpha Flight number 6. It's called Snowblind. It features Snowbird on the front. It almost feels 1970s. I want to say this probably came out in the early 80s. It was Alpha Flight. And there's so few lines in this cover that it's almost pure white. It has Snowbird right in the center, and there's little splotches of just off-white or yellow, and this fonting of Snowblind. You can tell exactly what this issue is about. Whether it's politically speaking or whether she is actually physically trapped in snow, this issue feels stark. It's so quickly drawn almost that it feels like shit's going down and like there's no answer. Like it's just complete. It's just a nihilist comic cover. I've always loved it. When I started collecting Alpha Flight years and years ago, it was probably one of the first ones I grabbed because I was like, I'm going to start from here because there's no other place to start but with this sort of gorgeous comic cover.
Yeah, it is a very cool cover, and it does, It gives you that sense of, like you said, you don't really know what's going on, but it also gives you almost like a mild panic kind of feel
Yeah.
because
It's just
it's
nothing.
just barren. It's like barren wasteland kind of cover, and it's like, oh God, this I can't see that this is gonna go well.
And, I can't even remember what the issue is about looking at the synopsis. Chief Inspector Hamilton orders an investigation of Constable Anne McKenzie's Colomac, who is the villain, recognizes Snowbird as the spirit of the Hodiak and the power of Nelvana and fights her with snow blindness. So there you go. So at some point in time in this issue, she is blinded, and I have to assume that since the art was done all by John Byrne in this issue on the cover, that there's a lot of pages of just sort of that blank starkness and her fighting, and I'm sure white eyes. It's like I said, it's always called to me. I've always found it to be very, very a sexy cover in the art way, not in the way that I will discuss later.
Very cool.
1984. There we go. Ha.
Okay.
Oh, hit me.
So the next one I went with, when I did collect comics, I was a big fan of independent publishers. My favorite was First Comics. They had a bunch of great titles. One of the favorites that I collected was a title called Grimjack.
I always remember those comic covers being really busy.
Some of them were. Grimjack especially, a lot of it came down to do with the art style. Flint Henry, great guy, met him at a couple of comic book conventions, hysterical. But he has an art style that's definitely his, and for Grimjack, there was a lot of busyness because it didn't hold back on stuff. So like, if the main character was summoning a demon on the cover, it was summoning a demon surrounded by intestines and, brain matter and stuff. And so there was a lot of busyness in the lines. But the character of Grimjack is a reincarnator. So the way the story started, his name was John Gaunt. And then right around this issue, which is issue 60, he comes back in the body of James Edgar Twilley, who was a high school kid, got abused by his dad, just didn't have a very good life, and then ends up waking up one morning and he's like, holy shit, kind of has this whole aha moment that there's something going on with him. So the cover of this is a high school yearbook with his pin and a gun and some pictures from high school, stuff in the past, prom and stuff like that. And the RSVP is that he's been asked back to his class reunion, and the invite is to Mr. James Twilley, and it's scribbled out and written John Gaunt underneath it because this was the first issue where the character had flipped. So it was about to be an aha moment for A, all of his friends and comrades, where he goes back to meet them now in this new body and new face. And also to a lot of his enemies who knew who to look for in the old body and now are going to be blindsided because it's the same guy with the same attitudes and the same prejudices, but looks completely different now. Think of it almost like a evil, vindictive Doctor Who
Right.
kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a neat cover. Your eyes immediately go to that RSVP. What I like about it, there's mixed media going on. The photos that are there are from the picture I see, they're actual photos.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's, the Ted in accounting, but there's a lot going on this one. I'm sure there's, where Truman High, I'm sure, is mentioned previously, whatever that alcohol is in the upper right there. I'm sure there's lots of sort of nods to the fandom going on here.
Oh yeah, well, he was a drinker, so quite definitely this is a bottle of vodka that's over here. So, and just because, like, you see the pencil scratch is not completely neat. It almost looks like this is a bad decision that's about to get worse.
Right.
Because we've got gun, we've got bullets, we've got punch blade, we've got vodka, and we've got an RSVP to a class reunion with a name that I am no longer scribbled out to the name that I always was and will be. But it was a good series. Jon Ostrander and Flint Henry did a lot of the story and the artwork on it for a good long section of the run. But I just liked this cover because it had that ominous feeling that shit was about to go down.
Yeah, no, this is there's definitely foreboding going on here. It's very Gross Point Blank.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you walked into your friend's room and you saw this on his table, there would be that pause, and then you'd look to the person that you came with, and then you'd look back at the table, and you'd be like, do you have his number?
Also, where's the door?
Yeah, exactly.
I gotta go.
We didn't touch anything when we came in here.
Fantastic. How many different personalities, I mean, rough guess, how many different personalities did the comic take on? Two or three, I assume?
He went through two in the span that first ran it. The series ended with issue 81.
Okay.
So for a good long section of the run, he was John Gaunt, and then he becomes James Twilley at the end. And then they did Grimjack Case Files, which were kind of redraws and reimaginings and republishings of some of the original stories of John Gaunt and how he became Grimjack, like when John Gaunt was a kid. First did this before they said they went on a hiatus, but they basically just disappeared for like 15, 18 years. I was talking to Marcus a couple weeks ago. They're actually back now doing a lot of the titles that they used to do. But they did this with another title, Nexus 2, where they did Nexus Legends, and they started reprinting old stuff that was character history, but before First got a hold of the character.
Gotcha. So during the pre-days, the salad days sort of thing.
Yeah, because Nexus came from, I want to say, like Carlton Comics or something like that.
Sure.
Before they were part of First Publishing. So they did a lot of that other stuff. But again, I loved Flint Henry's artwork is great. He did a couple runs on Batman where Batman is like possessed by this demon. So he's got like the super high ears and his feet are these taloned claws.
Gotcha.
And the bat symbol on his chest is very just like angular and sharp and edged.
Yeah, he
but
loves...
it was a fun book and the cover I really dig.
I dig it. It's super gritty. Even just from the shadow work and like there's like heavy ink, there's like lots of shadows. It's definitely foreboding.
Yeah.
All right, my next one. So iconic comic covers, I would be remiss and people would be upset if we didn't go with probably one of the most highly lauded, highly loved comic cover artists of all time. And that is Alex Ross. He does all of the all those really gorgeous. He's the one who basically has drawn comics that now you think of those versions of his characters.
Right.
The sort of super airbrushed, super stylized, super posed, photorealistic versions. Even our good friend Soak has his Joker Harley, where they're in like a dance sort of moment. He's got that tattooed on him. I went with Kingdom Come. I wasn't sure which one to go with, so I guess we'll just say number one, which features the reason Kingdom Come was such a big deal was because it was a look at the DC universe. I don't remember the exact time, 50 years, somebody will correct me. Now being super isn't all that important because there's so many superheroes. There's just metahumans everywhere. And this is a tale of redemption for a preacher who you learn more about as it goes. But this cover features all of these super characters. I mean, it's a who's who of superness. And then in the dead center is this sort of monochrome, black and white old man. And the story is told through him being told the story. And right next to him is Superman, and it's now an older Superman with a little gray around the gills. There's a Wonder Woman who's a bit older standing on his other side. In the background, you see these characters who you don't recognize, but you kind of recognize. Like, the Red Tornado is literally a Red Tornado. The Green Arrow, or whomever this is now a Red Arrow, so maybe it's not... I always want to call him Quiver. I know his name's not Quiver. Arsenal. And a bunch of other characters who I can't, not being a DC guy, I read this book multiple times and went, I know I'm missing a lot of subtext here because this is a lot of deep DC knowledge. But I always found these covers to be so interesting, especially this one, because Norman is, he's an old man and behind him are gods, effectively. And he's almost transparent. He's almost not real. He's got sort of this haze around him where the other ones are very, very static and all of them standing up straight and doing heroic poses. Kingdom Come, arguably one of the most beautiful comics I've ever done. The cover's right up there.
Yeah. Ross's big thing that I always enjoyed was A, everybody was proportional, which you don't always get a lot of in comic book covers.
Especially photorealistic ones. They really want to up the ante on it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, the Superman one on this, I will say this is probably my least favorite Superman logo.
Sure.
But is he broad-shouldered and trim-waisted? Yes, but he's like almost like a power lifter kind of build. But, like, he doesn't have the bulging throat and the tiny head and the barrel chest and the, you know, the size zero waist kind of thing that a lot of other comic book artists went into for a certain period of time in, like, the 80s and 90s, where it was all the very outside-the-box, ultra-unrealistic kind of poses.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, since these are painted, the contrast for the light and the lighting on this is what sells it. It's just absolutely ridiculous. It's almost the equivalent of the Queen album cover where everybody's like lit from the floor shining up and it gives you that larger than life kind of feel because they're all above the lighting. It's just amazing stuff. Everything on this cover is something that could, maybe with the exception of the Red Tornado being an actual tornado.
Right.
But it's like legitimate stuff that you could wear and make and be dressed as right now, and you could find somebody to pull this look off. It's not the super unrealistic superhero stuff. It's great stuff. All of his stuff is amazing.
Yeah, I have another one coming up later, but these covers, you mentioned the light. I also... his work with the way he makes metal look.
Yes.
I don't think I've ever seen a cover artist make metal look as beautiful as Alex Ross does. It feels, right. Even if you look, there's two metal characters on there, one with sort of the headpiece and one with literally a bullet. It's like a Silver Samurai looking head.
Yeah.
That's, you can tell that those two metals were hammered differently. Like, that's how good it is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I will always I'll always take a double check at an Alex Ross cover because he's always they're amazing. They really are. And this book is all done by him. So above that, you get full books full of this.
Yeah. The other thing that he did a lot of, not so much in this particular instance, but he did a lot of almost just like pitch black backgrounds.
Mm hmm.
Which made the lighting that he did for the stuff in the foreground just pop that much more. It's just ridiculous. Yep. It's amazing how you look at it and you're like, that's not painted. That has to be a guy. Yep. And if it's a guy, he's got to be real. And I don't know if I'm ready to accept that.
Yeah, there's this weird moment where you kind of go, this is that Superman. Shit, where'd he find him? Huh. I'm totally with you. And when you get into the book itself, and I know this is a gatefold cover, on the other side there's the old Green Lantern. The way he envisioned these characters as older and still be able to hold to their comic nature. And when I say that, I mean, you see Bruce Wayne as an old man and you kind of know what Bruce Wayne looks like in your head. You could pop him in there. To then imagine him not just as a future version of him, but as a photorealistic version of him,
yeah.
And go, oh no, he nailed it. That's photorealistic future, not real fucking Bruce Wayne. It's astounding. So yeah, Kingdom Come,
good stuff.
Blew my mind as a kid. What you got?
So I went. I also went with a gatefold on my next one. I liked it because it had. I wasn't a huge X-Men fan, but there were books that were out that I enjoyed. And I liked this one because it was such a huge amalgamation of a number of smaller teams that had come into existence at the time.
Ooh, I'm intrigued.
It is Uncanny X-Men 275. It's a three-page gatefold cover. It has, I'm going to say, like nine X-Men
Yep.
in the middle. And then you have kind of the bit players and antagonists
Yeah, all
on the sides
the
in like
Shi'ar.
purple shadow.
Yeah, that's all the Shi'ar who are in the background.
Yeah,
On the
well,
right
and you've
side.
got Rogue too.
Yeah.
You've got Rogue on the one side and Magneto. But you've got Banshee, you've got Gambit, you've got Forge, you've got Psylocke, you've got Wolverine, you've got Jubilee, you've got Storm, you've got Xavier in the giant armor in the back.
Yeah, but on
It's
the
just it's good stuff. And this is another one. I had this when I was younger and I was much more into drawing. I can't draw stuff from my head very well, but if I can look at something, I can recreate it. So this particular image I must have recreated on three poster board size posters 15, 20 times. I'd just open up the comic book next to me, and then I'd sit there with three giant, 3 foot by 5 foot poster board sheets and just freehand redraw it to scale and everything and color it in with markers. But I loved Forge. Forge was a great character. Gambit's one of my favorites. I'm a big Jubilation Leigh fan. I just thought her relationship and like the snarkiness back and forth with Logan at times was amazing. But they're all in the yellow and blue suits, so it shows them all as one cohesive team. It's just good stuff.
Yeah.
I believe this is I want to say this is a Jim Lee cover.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Good, great stuff.
Yeah, the this is funny enough, right around the issues when I got my first comic collection. This is right around where I started reading, and this is right before you get Bishop. It's right after when Gambit showed up on the team. You have Rogue, who's Savage Land Rogue, hanging out with Magneto, and they had just finished Space. I believe they were coming back home.
Yep.
But yeah, the color usage in this, all of the villains and all of the drama in the background, as this sort of muted purple, with them as bright yellow and bright purple and little splashes of red, super, super eye-catching.
Yeah, there were redos of this color where all of the side players are done in their regular full color. And it just becomes way too busy.
Yeah.
It takes away from the impact that this is the current X-Men team that we're seeing. And whereas it almost became like a thing for X-Men teams to not be very well cohesive, due to attitudes or personalities or game plans or whatever. But the fact that they're all drawn in the same uniforms just gives you the feel that, yeah, this may be picking and choosing from three or four most recent X-Men teams, but this is the team, and this is who is working together.
Right. And unified, no matter whatever else is going on, personal dramas aside. And I looking at that team, it doesn't I don't remember there being too much personal drama amongst those characters.
No.
They're all sort of well cohesively together. Like Rogue isn't with Gambit and Psylocke isn't with Archangel. There's none of those sort of everybody knows flaws. I think maybe Forge and Storm are the only two that might have a relationship going on here. But anyway, I do love just, you're correct. They look completely cohesive. They look ready to take down whatever's in front of them. It's a team to be reckoned with. And it's a good Wolverine. In
Yeah.
the various Wolverines of the day, that one's not bad.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of the, hey, Jubilees and Forge's legs look like they're way too long for their bodies,
Right.
but because of the pose they're in, it's that super, again, ultra realistic kind of action posey thing going on.
Yeah,
But
Forge's leg is a bit wonky.
yeah, but it's good stuff. One of my favorite covers.
I think the only one I don't like Xavier's headdress. I think that's the only thing that makes me go, "Oh, stop, Xavier. Just get in your
Well,
chair."
this was when he had the relationship going on with Warbird.
Yeah.
So that's like, what is that? That's Kree stuff? That's like the Kree battle armor?
Shi'ar.
Shi'ar. That's the Shi'ar battle armor thing that he's got going on. And I want to say that was one of the things at the time that allowed him to get up out of the wheelchair. I
Yeah.
may be remembering that incorrectly.
That sounds very familiar to me, so I'm going to have to believe that that is 100% correct. No one should ever question you on
Well, Tim's doing his best.
that.
It doesn't matter.
Looking through, I see other people who have redone this cover, and I don't love them as much as the actual cover. I think you're correct. Like
Yeah,
there's.
they did a variant where the actual red and yellow X-Men logo was in gold. This was around the time where everybody was doing the variant gold covers. But yeah, just like if you do a Google search, there's one where it's like, hey, it's a blue background and everybody's in full color, and it looks Hanna-Barbera-ish almost. It's just very oversaturated and busy.
Yeah, everybody talks about sort of the X-Men 1 gatefold cover, which is that one that flips out five long, big Magneto in charge on the front. I think you've convinced me that this one's better, that this is just it's a super iconically pretty image that shows them much more artistically than that one, because that one's very bright and like nonstop. They were probably just showing off printing techniques at that point.
Well, I think wasn't that X-Men 1 also had like not only was it a gatefold, but it also had five different
Yeah,
covers.
you could either build
Wasn't
the
there?
gatefold or you could
Yeah,
get the
there was one
gatefold.
for each team member, or you could buy the big gatefold one, yeah.
Yep. Oh yes, in the days of I have to buy all six of these even though it's the same story. I'm glad I've grown up.
I got sucked into it. I mean,
Duh.
I
Look.
won't deny it. I had a couple. Oh, if there's a gold cover that comes out, I'd like the regular and the gold cover,
Yeah,
please.
there's I'm not even going to admit some of the stupid comic book bullshit that I got myself suckered into because of hype, because of that, just, oh, this one's got gold leaf on the, oh, stop it. Be a man.
Well, I think what happened was, I think it was Ghost Rider number 5, where
Okay.
it was the Punisher crossover that had a huge amount of gold on the cover. That was a variant, was one of the first real popular gold covers, because the regular issue was like $5, and then that variant issue immediately went to like $25. So everybody was like, oh my God, if we make gold covers, people will buy them like crazy. And then that's what they did. They just completely oversaturated the market. New Mutants 100, Jesus Christ, there had to be like seven different versions of that. There was the purple with the white letters, there was the white with the gold letters, there was the white with the silver letters, there was the white with the pink polka dot letter. It was nuts after a while.
Yeah, and then when you got into the really deep bullshit of it, there you could get certificate versions of covers
Oh,
because they
yeah.
like the Dynamic Forces would come out with the this is the red metallic foil cover with the blood. This is the yeah. I used to have a collection of Kaboom comics. They are no longer in business, thankfully. I'm sorry, not Kaboom. Kaboom was the comic name. Awesome Comics was the company. I'm not even going to discuss it. So my next one, total different world. I'm going into the world of. Not beautiful art, just things Jamie likes. I love propaganda posters.
All right.
I have done them for In His Likeness. I've done a couple. I did a couple goofy ones. Just when I'm, they're fun. They're things that I like to draw when I'm bored. I'll do propaganda posters when I'm feeling artistic. There was a small maxi series, mini series, Elseworlds book called Superman Red Sun. I don't know which issue it is. I'm having a hard time finding out which issue this one was, but it is. All of them are all sort of propaganda posters.
Right.
The premise being Superman, the Earth tilted 12 hours. Superman does not land in Kansas. He lands in the middle of Mother Russia. This is Russian Superman. And he is the fighter of the Red Fight. He's got the hammer sickle on his chest. The one I love, it's half his face. It says he's watching you.
Nice.
And it's Superman's face done in red, red, black, and white. It's such a throwback to the old Red War propaganda posters where the government's looking out for you. Everything you do is being watched. Everything you hear is being recorded. Mind crime sort of stuff, that this image of Superman being that and so iconically Superman with he's watching you is horrifying and sort of wonderful. If you've never read Mark Millar's Red Son, and Millar is sort of divisive. Some people love him, some people hate him. This is probably one of his best pieces he's ever done. It's just a cool Superman story for people who hate Superman, because that's the world we live in. Did you find it?
Oh yeah, it was almost on my list.
Yeah. Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, it's a great cover and a great story.
Yeah, I know Wild Pig, we did it over at book club one time. There's a world of people who just don't feel they can relate to Superman, and I understand why. But I think there's enough variations of and versions of the characters that you can find a Superman you kind of go, "Oh, I get it. Like, this makes me understand the normal good guy Superman." And this is one of those books where it's so cool. It's such a neat premise.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't have much more to say about that other than, you know, yay propaganda posters.
even the cover, I don't know if it was the because that was a one shot, right?
No, this had like three or four issues. There's been various different covers as they've put it in trade paperback.
Yeah, the collected cover I really like too.
The one where he's standing over the sickle?
He's standing on the symbol, but the symbol is like a wall, so it's very three-dimensional, mm-hmm. and it's Superman Red Sun, but all the R's are backwards to give you that whole, you know, Russian kind of feel, because they print their R's backwards, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, no, good stuff.
Yeah, that tells you the whole story as to what you're looking at. It's the right there. I love that symbol. Anyway, you are next.
So, this one... I love for a couple different reasons. Number one, he was my least favorite Robin that ever did to exist. This was one of the ones that I got suckered into because I couldn't get them. They had run out when they were originally coming out, so I bought these as a 4-pack.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they had the little baggies you could get.
Yeah. And I paid way too much money for them because I was convinced that they were, you know, just going to continue to go up in price, and wow, did I get hosed. This is the third issue, 3 of 4, of A Death in the Family.
Yep, yep, yep. Is this the one with the phone number?
Yes, it is Robin lying, it's like a chest-up shot of Robin lying on the ground. There's blood, there's spittle, there's rubble lying all over him. And it's not only the image of him lying there, but the white text on the black sidebar. The Batman was too late, and now Robin lies in rubble, still shattered, silent. Could he possibly be alive?
Yeah, they have that like black bar with sort of poetry on them almost.
Yeah, and it was that way for all four of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was a great series. I loved the artwork in the book. I loved some of the panel layouts, especially when the Joker's beating the shit out of him. Him being, of course, Jason Todd.
Yes.
And him trying to save his mother and what he's doing versus the countdown timer on the bomb before it goes off. And I just love the background story of it, too, that like they set out a X amount of time that you're going to be allowed to call in and vote whether this guy lives or dies. And like 11 hours before the voting was over, he was alive by something like 85,000 votes. And then by the time the voting's over, he's dead by like less than 10,000 votes.
Wow. I didn't know it went so close. I just assumed that people were monsters.
Oh, no. From what I remember, he was alive for he had a pretty good lead going into it. But it kind of fell apart at the end of that, and not so much.
Yeah, no, and then, you know, tire iron to the face multiple times. Spoiler alert.
Well, that wasn't even what killed him, though. That just softened him up. because he comes to, and everybody's like, oh, he's not going to die after all. And his mom is tied to the pole in this shack, and it was like, I want to say it was 10 rows. Each row was maybe an inch tall, but the width of a comic book page. And 80% of that bar was him crawling his way over to his mother. And then the last part of that bar was a timer that showed like 10 seconds. And then the next bar was him getting closer. And then it was 9. And then trying to get the knots off. And it was 8. And he finally unties her with like 4 seconds left. And you're like, oh my God. And the tension's building. And they work their way to the door. And it's 1 second. And he reaches for the doorknob. And you hear like the sound effect is that. And he looks at her and goes, he locked the door. And the last one is 0, and you turn the page, and it was just one full page of, like, explosion. Like, not like Michael Bay explosion.
Right.
Like Charlie Sheen in The Wraith, where that barn gets blown into its component 2x4s kind of explosion. And that's what ended that book.
Well, if you're going to do it.
Yeah, and then it was like, hey, you can call in and see what happens.
Well, fair enough.
Okay, here we go. Over 10,000 votes were cast. The final vote, 5,343 votes to die versus 5,271 votes for him to live.
Wow. That is...
That was the difference. It was a lot... The number's clearly lower than I had thought, but the difference of living to die was ridiculous.
Yeah, that's excellent. I didn't realize it was such a tight race. I just assumed... My theory is...
He was still alive, like, for pretty good.
Yeah, that's excellent.
O'Neill said, I heard there was this one guy who programmed his computer to dial the thumbs down number every 90 seconds for 8 hours. And this was when it was a 1-900 number and 50 cents per call.
Right, yeah. It cost that guy, like, $300 to make sure this poor comic fictional character dies.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going with my next Alex Ross cover, just to get them both out of the way.
Sure.
Probably one of my favorite comic series of all time. It's had a couple rebirths. I believe it's now under DC. I don't know whether it's under one of their little sub... because it was under Image, and then it was under Wildstorm. It's called Astro City. It's Kurt Busiek's book.
Okay.
It's about this sort of living, breathing city... and the superheroes that are in it. It's a very Manhattan sort of town, but people go to Astro City because that's where the superheroes live. There's superheroes in other places, and they get into that, but this is very much about human stories of superheroes in a human place, like a living city. So some of the comics are about tourists who show up to the city because they want to see the superheroes. Other ones are about superheroes that tried and failed. They're all very human stories. They're all really well written. and there's slow plot lines that he sort of reveals as you go. Like, you know, one of the characters was arrested once, and you don't get that story for years upon years of comic books. But if he eventually tells it, because it's a story he wanted to tell at the time, he tells the story of, like, the speedster who, you know, can't live like a normal human because he's really super fast. Anyway, the cover I chose was actually number one, because it's Astro City number one. It was done from Image. It's Alex Ross. The character on the dead center there is the Samaritan, who's their Superman analog. And it's such a religious-y sort of pose, while at the same time, you know, you're looking at a Superman character. He's in that same Superman flying pose, but the sun behind him creates a halo. Everybody's looking up and pointing at him. And you can, you know, what look up in the air. Is it a bird? Is it a plane sort of pose?
Right, right.
But I find the superhero as religious figure analog there. And this is our hero, and this is why what we came to see. While also telling you, you're in New York. These are people who... just love looking at heroes. On top of it being Alex Ross, which is, you know, again, earlier in his career. So there's much more of a, it looks less photorealistic and more painted, but that doesn't change the fact that it's just sort of beautiful.
To me, it looks very color pencil-ish.
Sure.
I know in zooming in on this, yes, it's painted. It doesn't have the cleanliness that a lot of his later painted stuff does, but it definitely looks like if you said, hey, I want you to do your cover, but instead of using paint, use colored pencils, this is what it would come out like.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the cover now. Yeah. I mean, even the building that is kind of behind him looks very Daily Planet-ish.
Yes.
I
think he wanted you to get the ground running so you knew what was going on. I mean, it tells you a lot about what's going on inside the comic with just being one picture.
Yeah, good stuff.
And for anybody who's never at Astro City, holy crap, I reread it a couple years ago, and I had to tweet Busiek and be like, thank you for writing this. Holy shit. And all those covers are fairly iconic. He does some Norman Rockwell stuff later. A lot of gorgeous work in here. I probably could do a top 10 list of my favorite Astro City comics and not feel bad.
Very nice. Yeah, it's really good stuff.
What you got?
So I went with another one of my indie darlings that I loved collecting. Howard Chaykin's American Flag.
Mm-hmm.
FLAGG exclamation point.
Those are the comics I always think of as busy. Those are the ones with the like real tight, the Chaykin loves like little itty bitty details everywhere.
Yes. The other thing that I really like about him, it's very noir. It's very pulpy feel to it. I can forgive him the fact that every one of his leading men look the same. Like they have the same face, just different haircut. Like that's how he draws his leading man. It's the same face over and over and over again.
Right.
But a lot of what he does for colors and for fabrics, it's almost like I'm going to draw a guy in kind of like a broad-shouldered kind of zoot suit kind of thing, like a double-breasted jacket and pants kind of thing. And then I'm going to take an X-Acto knife and I'm going to cut along the inside of the ink for the outline of the suit. So now I just have a suit that is basically clear. And then I'm going to take that image and I'm going to put it just on a square of fabric. So it doesn't fall the way it would if the suit were actually made of that fabric, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of like a static, this is the image that, you know, pick this, fill. And it just fills it. But I went with Jukebox Saturday Night. It's American Flag number 2. Every one of his comics had like a subtitle to it, because if you had never read American Flag before and you weren't sure of what you were getting yourself into, this is an image that will just give you everything you need to know about what you need to prepare yourself for reading a Howard Chaykin American Flag comic.
This is a gorgeous cover.
It is.
I've never seen it.
It's got your pulpy bits. It's got your kind of cheesecake bits, with the chick in the garters and the skirt and the stockings. It's got his, how the guns are getting fired, where you've got like the muzzle flash, but then you've got that long trailer of where the bullet's going. That's huge throughout his, throughout a lot of his artwork.
Mm-hmm. And the jukebox as the American flag is pretty neat, because you can tell exactly what it is from the shapes.
Yeah, but it definitely gives you that feel of, okay, so it's very noir, it's very pulpy, there's going to be some sexy bits to it. He's not afraid to shy away from that. And the girl that he's holding in that picture, I believe, is the mayor. So just so you get an idea of, oh, okay. So even like, you know, the chief of police, there's a scene where, you know, she meets him in his car as he pulls up to the new precinct that he's a part of. And like the first thing she does is she gets in his passenger seat and she pulls a gun on him and she's like, drive, because she's trying to get to know who he is. And they're driving and he's like, okay, well, I don't get why you got to pull a gun on me, but this is where I'm from, this is what I'm doing, everything else, da da da. And then they get like 5 or 6 panels into it. And then the next panel is she puts her heel up on the dashboard and kind of the jacket falls open and it's, you know, garter and stockings, and she's like, "Now pull over." And you're like, "Okay,
right."
You know, and then it cuts away to whatever the other subplot is, but it's his thing. He does very pulpy, very noir kind of stuff, and the artwork is very definitively his.
Yeah, this is very Taken. It seems very Bond, which I like.
Yeah. But if you ever saw his Blackhawk run that he did for DC, the character of Blackhawk and the character of Ruben Flagg, same guy, slightly different haircut. it's just how he draws leading guys. But I'm a huge fan of Chaykin. When I stopped collecting comics, I was five comics short of having an entire run of 1 to 50 of American Flags, and then 1 to 12 of the Maxi series where he's over in Russia, and it was American Flag, but the R was backwards, and it was a K instead of a C.
Right.
For no other reason than I wanted to own a whole set because I loved his stuff.
Yeah, just looking through these covers.
It's not like they were going up at all. It's not like people were going to pay $1,000 for a complete set. I just had a bunch of them, and I ended up at a comic book show, and I'm looking at some guy's, you know, back issue bin for 50 cents, and I'm flipping through, and all of a sudden it was like, oh my God, the guy's got like 17 of these. So I bought all of them and got them home, and I'm like, I am really fucking close. So then I just started going to other comic book stores and shows, seeing if anybody had American Flag back issues.
Looking at these covers, I can dig it. I don't think I've ever looked through them. They remind me of the Spirit in sort of that pulpy cheesiness.
Yeah.
But yeah, those are super fun. I'm now sad I didn't catch on to that one. And you've mentioned it like a half a dozen times.
You can find them in trades every now and then. You can find them in trades.
Right.
It's like he usually does like 3 to 5 issues in a storyline. So like Southern Comfort was 5 issues. And you'll find like a Southern Comfort trade that was just those 5, that 5-issue story arc. And they also had great titles too, like the subtitles: Jukebox Saturday Night, Tales of the Plexus Rangers, Red Highlights and Permanent Waves. You know, it was just a lot of really cool schlock stuff, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
It just had that very cheesy, pulpy feel to it.
Well, my next one is I think you'll start to notice a pattern here. With this one, this is Uncanny X-Men number 303. It's a white cover, and this one might actually have gotten me because it is the content of the issue as well. I might not have been able to separate this one, but it's very rare for an X-Men book to have sort of words that tell part of the tale. It is a comic cover done by Richard Bennett. Features Jubilee holding, being held by Jean Grey, and it says, if you read one X title this month, this issue must be it. And it is stupidly a sad, gut-wrenching book because it's right after Ilyana Rasputin's died.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I don't remember whether this isn't the funeral, because that's the one where Wolverine gets the adamantium pulled out of him. This is all of the X-Men dealing with the death of one of their own.
Mm-hmm.
Very specifically, Jubilee and Jean Grey, since Jubilee's so young and she's never seen death and all that other stuff. But again, it's a stark cover with like this huge shadow, which is, you know, very symbolic of the fact that they're dealing with something. I find that in the little bits of detail of this book, it tells a lot of what goes on. But yeah, there's it just exudes sadness. You know that this book is not going to be happy, and
yeah.
they since it's if you read this, you know, it's the one you must read. You think that it's probably going to be this monumental moment in X books, and it's so not. It's just a let's talk about humanity. Let's absorb death for a minute, and you're like, oh, this is. But I've always loved this cover just for, again, its starkness. There's one more. I got one more stark one coming up. But, I find this one to be just, it tells a tale. And it's what's in the book. So there you go.
I like the negative space use of the all white. I like how the clickbaity kind of subtitle overlaps some of the images on the background, so it gives you a feeling of depth to it. This is also a cover that had a gold leaf variant to it, and the gold leaf just completely ruins the feel of what you're looking at, because the gold leaf takes away the depth, in my opinion, and just makes it very flat. But the white just gives it this feeling like it's almost like a like institutionalized kind of room that they're in, with just the white with no borders that you can tell.
And with those little shapes, like it gives you just enough to let you know they're like huddled in a corner.
Yes, yeah, but the gold leaf just completely ruins it.
Thoroughly. That would hurt my feelings to see that.
Yeah, good stuff.
All right, what do you got?
All right, I went with this is probably a very mainstream popular one, especially given the current state of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Infinity Gauntlet number one.
Oh, sure. All right. Let's
The
take.
one where Thanos is kind of holding the glove up in front of him in a clenched fist with all the gems, and you've got those crazy refracting lines taking up, it basically bisects and intersects numerous different places on the cover, but it also uses those lines to frame other players in the game, like Mephisto and Death and stuff like that. It's an iconic cover. It's a very well-parodied cover. It's a very well-known cover. I dare say that for anybody who is remotely into any sort of comic book fringe knowledge, you could take the title bar off of that and hold up that picture, and people could tell you what it is.
Yeah. What I've always loved about this cover is that the layout, the way the beams separate the various factions. I've always found that to be so super sexy. Because it's not a story just about Thanos, but he's at the center hub of Silver Surfer and the Hulk and Captain America and Mephisto or whomever that is, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just always a favorite of mine. That's one of my favorite big crossover stories too that they've ever put on paper. Marvel and even DC to a point had this problem where they'd start a crossover like gangbusters. The middle would be kind of cool, even if a little ham-fisted, but then they kind of didn't know how to end it. And Infinity Gauntlet, it almost kind of fixed that in the fact that they didn't really have to end it because Thanos was just like, "Nah, I almost had it. I'm gonna go be a farmer now," and just kind of like just gave up the ghost himself and said, "Fuck it all, I'm done. This is now too much work. I've eliminated half of the known universe. I have created a new universe in which half of the known universe is constantly being sacrificed to the woman who won't give me the time of day. Eh, too much work."
Yep. You didn't mention it's a George Perez cover, obviously. We figured we should
Yeah.
at least mention that.
Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, it's a good one. You would be hard pressed to find one of those best lists that doesn't include it high up there,
Yeah.
along with a bunch of books I know we didn't put on our lists. Crisis on Infinite Earth and that sort of stuff. George Perez has done some of like literally the defining comic covers, and it should at least be mentioned since he's probably only represented with that one
Yeah, right.
on our list. Because my next one goes completely like, really? All right, fine. I think that I out of the list that I have here of what's left, I legitimately don't have anything else super iconic. Everything else is sort of these are things Jamie likes.
I have one that's iconic, one that might be underground iconic, and then I actually have three real quick honorable mentions that I want to throw out.
Yep, I
But
got two honorable. It's quick, and we're running so late on this episode for just talking
that's all
about art.
right.
No, I don't give a damn, but yeah.
Our president's one was short, so.
That's true. That's very true. So I'm going with a very modern cover. Came out in the last, I want to say, see, now I'm bad with time. It's probably 2 years now. It's Daredevil. Here we go. Daredevil version 3, number 12. If you guys are following along, it's V3, number 12. Check your bingo cards. You can tell it's a Paolo Rivera cover. It is probably one of the sexiest covers, comic covers I've ever seen. It features the top, the neck down of a woman, and she's undressing, obviously, to go hang out with Mr. Murdock. You get to see some of the lacy bits underneath, But you get to see sort of what I love about it is you see what Daredevil sees, and that's the heartbeat. He hears her heartbeat. He probably can use some of his sonarness, depending which version you're looking at, to see a bit of the sort of hatch lines across her. So he sees just little smidges of her. But I've always found this cover super sort of sexy. And, you know, whether or not people like it, this one's on my list. For a while, I even think I had it as like my Facebook icon. I thought it was so cool. It's stark red background. You don't see any of like what the details of what she's wearing. The details are all in the skin, done with the sort of seismic lines and just some color, barely any color shading on what's going on underneath. Just neat.
Yeah, it kind of blends what you would see and what he would see because her hands and her arms are drawn normally. But then, like, the top of her chest lead into her cleavage is very kind of seismic lines, like you said, like what you think he would see.
Yeah.
And it's very...
It's stupid suggestive.
It's very similar to the Dark Knight cover I mentioned because her dress, except for the buttons, is all black. There's no separation from jacket or shirt to skirt or pants. It's just, like, one solid wall of color. So color-wise, it's very minimalistic, but I really dig it. I also like... The Daredevil font is the same, but the Man Without Fear underneath it is very kind of Sky Captain 50s kind of War Bonds-y font, it looks like.
Yes.
So, it gives you that kind of throwback, pulpy, noir kind of feel to it.
Yeah, the book at this point in time, Mark Waid was writing, it was after they'd gone through all of the Bendis grittiness, so it got a little more fun and a little bit more pulpy. You are 100% correct that the fonting there is by choice to make you realize this isn't as serious as some of the more darker Daredevil stories that had been around for a couple years.
Yeah, I can't look at this without reading it in my head going, "The Man Without Fear."
Fight the Red Menace.
Yeah, exactly.
That's me.
Good stuff. All right, so this one, I don't know how iconic the cover is. This was one of those ones where I couldn't separate cover from story. And the story was fantastic. It's a Sandman comic book.
Ooh.
And a lot of his were...
Those covers.
Especially in the middle, they were kind of like amalgamations where it was very mixed media kind of stuff where it was artwork and dried flowers and, you know, a coffee stain and something drawn in pencil and something colored in paint. I went with number 19. It's part of the Dream Country storyline. Mm-hmm. It's A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yep, yep.
And I went with it, A, because I love the internal story. It's kind of a one-off where he meets... the Fae, and they perform A Midsummer's Night Dream for the people that the play is about. It's one of the plays that was commissioned by Dream to Shakespeare.
One of the two.
The final page of the the final page of the play, basically Robin Goodfellow drugs the guy playing Robin Goodfellow and proceeds to play himself. So as he goes through the whole "if we shadows have offended, think but this is all is mended" soliloquy, you zoom in closer and closer on Robin, but he gets darker and darker, more into the shadows, until the next to last panel is just his eyes and a Cheshire Cat smile, and then the last panel is just complete pitch black, but the word bubbles are still there in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Just great artwork. But for a Sandman cover, I think you have to admit, this is probably one of the more lighthearted ones because it's very light in tone and in color scheme.
Yeah.
A lot of the Sandman ones are very either like dark mahogany wood grain or dark greens and browns. This just has a different feel to it. It's almost kind of like a lace kind of feel to it, the way the mixed media and kind of the cream-colored background blend together.
Yeah, Dave McKeon, who did all these covers, he's... a weird sort of mixed media genius. From what I understand, his attic is just this strange hodgepodge of, because he goes and he makes these things. Like, to some degree, they're painted, of course, but there's also, that's probably real textured cheesecloth or lace or whatever that is.
Yeah, no doubt.
He's apparently there's a lot of bird cages, you know, and I know those appear in Sandman covers quite a bit. Yeah. So you're right. This one is definitely a departure, and I think it's a departure as a book as well.
Oh yeah.
And it's I know it's one of the comics that people who are trying to get friends to read Sandman, they go read the Midsummer Night's one. Just go with this one. You'll get it.
Yeah, that one or the Hobgalding one, which was another great story, but the cover was nothing to write home about. So I'm like, I can't. Although I would love to put that on my list because I love the story, I just couldn't. The cover was nothing spectacular out of that run of covers that he had put out.
And these covers, I mean, you can read through the issue and then come back to the cover and start to see maybe what Dave McKeown was going for. That's what I've always found interesting. You can look and go, oh, there's okay. So he saw that and he thought that looks like Puck. So that's sort of Puck in the shadows over his face and everything. Or, you know, what have you. Or maybe this is just the Fae that are sort of swimming around in this weird yellow, orange, green thing. These books are gorgeous. The covers of these, there's books about these covers. And that should just tell you where you're looking at.
Yeah, good stuff.
Okay, so I'm going to get my pervy one out of the way, and then we'll be done with that, because I did the sexy Daredevil, and now I'm going to do a cover that people have looked at me weird when I tell them it's I think it's... it's a sexy cover because it's drawn sexily, not because it's like a 19-year-old. It's NYX number one. It's done by Josh Middleton. And this book I loved. It's about this girl, Kaiden. She's a club kid. She stumbles on powers. She doesn't know what to do, but she stumbles on them when she's tripping balls. And I found that the color work and the color artistry in this cover is so pretty. And she's kind of got that spaced out look, and she's got the pacifier and the candy necklace. Like, it's so such a clearly like club E scene going on. But this is her like getting hit with powers. And I find that to be such a cool thing that I'd never seen in comics where, especially in Marvel, in mainstream comics, where you're looking at a kind of a drugged out trippy scene, and then they get hit with the power moment, and then they run into X-23. This is the storyline that introduced her to the Marvel Universe. I found this cover to be so cool that it sat on my favorites list forever. The book done by the cover done by Joshua Middleton, the book done by Joe Quesada. Didn't do very well, the book, other than X-23. It's really the only reason the book existed. And Kaiden sort of disappeared as a character. But I've always found the way Joshua Middleton draws these faces to be so super gorgeous. You know everything about this girl right from the minute that it goes. And it's either she's being attacked by powers or she's feeling powers. But you're there then. You're in that moment.
Yeah, it really looks like she's having a hard time distinguishing, are these powers, or am I just completely fucked up?
Yeah, or am I just tripping hardballs right now?
Yeah, yeah. The lines on this are very, very delicate, which kind of leads into the whole, you've got the crazy, trippy, colored pastel background, and then you've got, it looks like she's kind of airbrushed, because you've got no lines separating the light and the shadows that are on her. It's a very thin lined but clean cover. It is very cool.
Yep, it's the line where I think that's probably what called to me is that thin, like so thin. There's no shadow that isn't still a full color. Like the shadows that are in this book are still like, oh, that's skin tone. It's such a bright cover, and that's so unusual. It's right around when everything went super digital. So I'm sure again, this is one of those. Hey, let's see what we can push out. NYX number one. It's weird. It's a weird cover, and I've never doubted that. And my girlfriend at the time was like, "You're just a fucking weirdo," and I was like, "Yeah, I am." But this is just it's a cool, sexy cover.
Very cool. All right, so I went back to Howard Chaykin. Well,
hit it.
This was a two part. It was a two book. Issue. It is. He did a two-issue run of Guy Gardner Green Lantern. So if you type into Google Green Lantern, or if you type into Google Guy Gardner Chaykin, You will see the book I am talking about.
I sure will.
The thing that I liked about it is it still shows kind of his disregard for, like, comics code authority kind of thing, even though I'm fairly certain that they weren't around anymore by the time this book came out. But this came in a polybag, which usually means not for the youngins to see.
Yep.
And the reason it did, the polybag basically just covered up the bottom third of the cover. So what you see is Guy Gardner. Again, if you look at Guy Gardner and you look at Reuben Flagg, face very the same except for the Guy Gardner haircut. And he's got his fist up in front of him with the power ring, and the ring is kind of illuminating his face in that, you know, weird green kind of glow. But when you take it out of the polybag, you realize that the bottom of the polybag, he's basically giving you the old Italian salute with the Green Lantern ring.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really cool story. The artwork was typical Chaykin, but I like Guy Gardner as a Green Lantern, and I think I started to like him through a lot of the Justice League America that Giffen and DeMatteis were doing, because they tempered his "I'm a douche" with "but come on, I'm funny" with a lot of his attitude, so he wasn't just like, you know, the guy who tries way too hard and is just a jerk with, okay, fine, you can sit with us, you know, kind of attitude. And he kind of kept it going in this one here. But this cover was great. This was actually the unlock screen on my cell phone for a good long time.
Is Guy Gardner the one that turns into a villain? Or I know very little about Green Lantern.
He becomes the Warrior, I believe it was.
And one of them turns into Parallax. That's all I remember.
I don't know if that was Gardner or not.
I don't, probably not.
I picked this book up well after I had stopped collecting comics. Basically, I had gone into one of my comic book shops to visit a friend of mine who was working there, and I saw this on the shelf, and I was like, hey, what's going on? Hello, what is this? Because it was just like, that's Chaykin. What is he doing? Guy Gard? Okay, I'll take this one, and let me know when the next one comes in.
The light that is, I mean, the whole back is just a stark red, but the light source being just the ring is super, super pretty.
Yeah, like, yeah. It's very cool.
That downlight that's coming down, you know, from his nose, the shadow of his nose across his face. There's some really, like, smart decisions as far as just how to make him lit. And I think what really adds to it.
Yeah, it's a really cool cover, and I really like it. And it basically gives you the attitude of the character and, vicariously, the artist who did the character, basically all summed up in that one image.
Yeah, and I'm looking at other versions of him when he's standing there and he's wearing his, like, full 1980s Thriller outfit, and I'm like, yeah, all right, I understand when we are.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so.
But yeah, totally dig it. All right, I'm going to go with my last of the Jamie Likes big white black big white blank canvases. This is Ghost Rider number 21. It
Ooh.
Is referred to as Snowblinded. And it's another one of those books that the cover alone, I would put as not a Ghost Rider guy, as someone who finds Ghost Rider a little played sometimes. It's a Joe Quesada cover with Jimmy Palmiotti. It's so interesting of a cover to me, just the art of it. It features Ghost Rider in the dead center, big stark white background. It again is called Snowblinded, similar to my Alpha Flight one. He's been hit with a spear of some sort, and
he has,
and the spear has dislocated Ghost Rider's jaw. That image of just the jaw hanging from the skull, and because Ghost Rider's supposed to be this unkillable machine. He's a spirit of vengeance brought to wrong the rights and hoping that he can leap home. This shows him weak and forced down, and you don't know if he's going to survive it, and it's through his eye, and you don't know whether that's how he sees anyway, because he's a fucking skull. And the sort of haze and the vengeance-y, flamey bits that are coming off go up into the title card and off-panel. I've always found this to be like a poster worthy picture.
Oh yeah. It's not even that the vengeancy flamey stuff is, it almost looks like they're they're fighting to keep from being extinguished.
Yeah, they're like disintegrating, you know, off of him.
Yeah, it's like that second when you blow a candle out and that flame is kind of doing that weird being affected by the wind before it gets extinguished. And this spear literally looks like it's also pinning him to the ground too. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't just stand up. Like, I'm going to have to slide my hand and my face up off the end of this spear to extricate myself from it.
Yeah.
And the pose, yeah, that's a good one.
The pose is so, like, defeated. I mean, you look at his pose, he's got one knee sort of one leg underneath him and one sort of braced upwards. Like, that's a pose you have to roll on your stomach to get out of. Like, you're just completely exposed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not a Ghost Rider guy, but this cover has always spoke volumes to me as far as just well put together and well formed, just body language alone.
Good stuff. That's a good one.
What do you got?
All right, my next one, it doesn't need a whole lot said about it. It's the Killing Joke.
Ah, very good. We're going to get lost.
Another one that I recreated and redrew countless times. I actually redid this one on poster board for a friend of mine who ran a comic book store in my town. He did a comic convention up in New York City, took the poster with him, and had it in a frame on the back of his setup. And I went up there to visit him, did the comic book show. At the end of the day, he pulls me aside and he goes, "Do you know I had 75 people ask me where they can buy that poster because it's never been printed in poster form?" Mm-hmm. And I had to tell them, "Oh no, a friend of mine who buys through my shop redrew that for me on Oak Tag and painted it with fucking poster board paints and stuff." Brian Boland. There's great artists out there, Alex Ross, Jim Lee, you know, just to name a few. But Boland is probably my personal favorite, right up there with Chaykin. His style is so definitive,
mm-hmm.
and will never be mistaken for anybody else's. I love his use of hatch lines instead of using different shades of the same color for shadows. That he'll just keep cross-hatching and cross-hatching and cross-hatching to get his point across that something is deeper in shadow than something else. The entirety of Killing Joke, Camelot 3000 was another one. The storyline was kind of, okay, but it was book and Brian Boland artwork.
Right, right.
And you can never go wrong with that. And it's just great stuff. I will never get tired of looking at it.
I mean, it's a cover that, just like you said, it's been reproduced and replayed, and you know exactly what book it came from, and you know why it's as vicious as it is. You know, it speaks so much to everything going on in that book.
Yeah, if you've never read the book before, you look at the cover and think that the Joker is taking your picture, and you're like, whoa, what am I getting myself into?
Right.
And then you read it, and you realize where in the machete cut that cover goes in the story, and you're like, oh, God. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, dear. No, I don't want. And then you take the comic book, and you just turn it over. So it's face down on your desk, because you don't want him looking up at you after that.
I understand completely why you picked it. I know it's one of your favorites.
Yeah, good stuff.
Okay, so this is my last one. Again, these are in no order. If I had thought about it, I probably would have put one of the comics I read at the top, like the X-Men books. But hey, is what it is. My last one is, it's sort of one of those modern comics that I've seen replicated and duplicated. I've seen cosplay of this cover a couple times. It is, again, I hate volumes. Volume 3 of Catwoman, number 51. It's an Adam Hughes cover. It's sort of known as the Arrested cover. It's Selina Kyle in her full Catwoman getup, standing with the marker board in front of her with the Gotham City. She's being arrested. It's her mugshot. And very photorealistic. She looks pissed, upset. She looks like she is ready to just wreck you.
Hello.
Yeah. It is sexy on top of it. Because she has Adam Hughes, not one to not draw breasts, so, but her expression is phenomenal. Aside from the fact that he really, like, he does this latex, so it looks very real. And his skin tones are like on point. but her eyes are like shaded in pink. She's got eyeliner and mascara like flowing down. There's teardrops on her chin. This is a Catwoman that, you know, the minute she gets out of there, shit's going down.
Yes.
So I believe it's a storyline, if in case anybody wonders, with the black mask. It's right after a anniversary issue of number 50. So, you know, there's a lot going on here. I don't, and again, I didn't read the book, and I know there's people out there going, "Hadn't you fucker? I don't read DC." But from what I understand, this is like one of the best runs of Catwoman ever. But love this cover. I find it. I've seen posters. I've seen, like I said, I've seen cosplay. I've seen girls walk around in the outfit holding the placard.
Right.
And that tells you that you hit a mark somewhere. So.
Yeah. Yeah. The look on her face, it's like she's trying not to give away how pissed she is. Yet you can also get a sense in her eyes that she is taking in every detail of the guy taking her picture right now. Because the minute this gets rectified, I'm going to fucking own you.
Yeah. Or but just stewing, you know, even if it's just stewing over everything that led up to this moment. I'm going to fucking kill him. I'm going to take down Batman. I'm going to take down the Black Hand. I'm going to take down the Joker. I'm going to raise up Jason Todd. I'm going to kill him again.
I can't believe he made up the entire story by looking at the fucking bulletin board behind me. It's that face. But, you know, cleavage aside, this fucking vinyl is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, I'm looking at this and I almost can't believe that this is not some sort of photography, you know, model that he used and just used the picture, that this is actually painted, even if it's digitally colored or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
This is ridiculous.
Yeah, and you want to know what's, you could, we could get an email from someone who goes, no, he used his model, took, you know, shoulder up and then blended up. And I would go, okay, I believe it. I don't think that's how Hughes works. I think he works similar to Ross in that this is a real person that he then, you know, modeled around and probably traced quite a bit. But at the same time, doesn't matter. It's fucking cool.
Yeah, that's amazing looking. Good stuff.
And was that that?
Oh, well, I have one last one.
Oh, hit it.
I have a couple honorable mentions
that
I'll just rifle through real quick.
Yeah,
my last
too.
One, it's also one of my, probably my second favorite comic book story arc. It is from Kraven's Last Hunt, and it is the first issue called Coffin, Web of Spider-Man, Kraven's Last Hunt number one, subtitled Coffin. It is a picture of Spider-Man in the black suit on the ledge of a building with the city looking out behind him. He has like Kraven's hemp and rope net just completely tossed over him. And he's got kind of his hands up in that, hey, please don't shoot, while you've got the barrel of the gun from off camera coming down onto the scene, aiming at him.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically starts off that whole storyline where, you know, it's not enough for me to just capture the Spider-Man. I have to kill the Spider-Man and become the Spider-Man, and that is the only way that I can truly have beaten the Spider-Man kind of thing. But just that, the whole story was just dark as hell.
Yeah, it's an iconic one.
But that one cover basically just gives you the whole pretense that, you know, there is not going to be many light spots, if any, in this entire run when we're showing you that this is the start of it. And it's just a great image to show somebody that is usually very flippant, very able to get out of things, very willing to take risks, that he manages to work his way out of in such a vulnerable and precarious and deadly position. Really just kind of sets the tone for the whole story to follow.
Yeah, all of the covers of the Kraven's Last Hunt story are so gorgeous in their line work. There's so much detail in the rain and the webbing and the Michael Zeck did the cover of these. They're similar to when you first saw McFarlane's covers.
Yep.
You can just sit and like lose your eyes in them looking at pen strokes.
Yeah.
And each one of these covers, I agree. I think the second one, with the one where he's in front of the grave,
yep,
I love a little more. That's just me, But yeah, each one of these covers is gorgeous. That gun where the looker of the comic, the reader, that's the word I needed, is holding the gun. It's such a unique perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm all over it. I'm totally down with you. Plus, I love DeMatteis.
Yeah, very good stuff.
Ah, great. We did entire issue about comics.
Yeah, I got 3 honorable mentions. I'm just going to blast through real quick.
Yep, I got 2, so go for it.
The first one is Dawn, after they had the split for Cry for Dawn. Lindsner went on to do Dawn as a solo book. It's issue 3 of Lucifer's Halo, which was the first story arc. It's a blue background cover. There's a lot of characters going on that are kind of a cornflower blue on a royal blue kind of background, so it's very subtle and muted. But she is the character in the foreground wearing like a white tank top, jeans, and holding this halo. And the whole story of Lucifer's Halo is that since she's the goddess of birth and rebirth, she kind of has free reign to go to both heaven and hell, and neither Lucifer's or Lindsner's version of supreme good being, Ahura Mazda, gives her too much shit for going there. So they realize that there's a mistake that has happened in both of their pasts that has never been rectified, which is getting the halo that he gave Lucifer when he was an angel back and bringing it back to heaven. So she goes and talks to him and says, hey, I'll go down there and get it for you. And he's like, fine, whatever, I don't care, trying to pretend like he doesn't care. She goes down to hell and Lucifer's like, I never wanted it anyway, which was a complete and total lie, because you get the whole story of why he doesn't really want to let it go. But then she doesn't go and give it back to heaven either. She gives it to this guy that she met that goes from one night stand to kind of constant lover, because when the angels and the demons both come after it to reclaim it and bring it to where they think is it rightfully belongs, it brings him out as the horned god, which was he always was, but he had forgotten, so she needed to wake him up.
Oh yeah.
So she brings Cernunnos out of him by putting him in the situation of, you know, I've had to kill angels and demons and, you know, gods and kings and queens, and now I know who I am, kind of thing. But the cover was very cool.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous cover, especially because he does everything in the muted blue in the background, so you see all that details sort of subtly, with her being much more sprightly and sort of adorable in the foreground.
Yeah.
You can always tell somebody who really likes Dawn. Do you want to know how?
Because
they understand it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I started collecting Dome when I was at a really weird and bad time in my life, and there was a lot of stuff that he wrote that kind of spoke to me, and I loved he was doing painted panels at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just amazing stuff, and I was a huge fan of his. The one tat that I have is basically all Cry for Dawn imagery. So it's just really good stuff.
Yeah, over the years, I've read Dawn. I've read that the Lucifer's Halo storyline, because I have the trade. I've read it, I want to say, twice. When I first read it, and I'm talking when I was like 19, 20, I was so in like comic book mode. I was like, I don't understand any of this. Whatever. She's got cool boobies. Later, as I read it, I started to go, oh, it's all symbolism, and this represents this archetype, and this is this, and I started to piece it together. But always beautiful work, you know.
Oh, yeah. Crazy good stuff. I also have a very minimalist cover, very similar to yours. It's a variant of Watchmen number 11.
Ooh.
I call it the snow cover. It is completely white, except for what looks like a little patch of snow that has been brushed away by a hand. And you see butterfly and a bunch of tropical flowers.
Yes, I know that.
And it's when Rorschach and Night Owl happen to stumble across Ozymandias's secret winter base, and they find the dome, and like they knock on it and they're like, hey, wait a minute, this isn't snow, and they brush it aside and they see that giant like terrarium room that he has. Mm-hmm. But it's the view that they have from the outside. I always thought it was very awesome that you use all that negative cover space as the snow, and then you get that sense of what's underneath it. And the last one I have is Ghost Rider 15. For no other reason than the fact it is a close-up of what looks like just a black and white pen and ink drawing of Ghost Rider's skull and his vengeancey flames around his face.
Oh yeah, that one.
But it's a glow in the dark cover. So you turn it off and the flames become a lot more wispy and airbrushy kind of look. And I just thought it was very cool at the time. I bought two issues of that comic book. One went in the poly bag with the backer board in my box. The other one went in a poly bag and got taped to the wall of my bedroom because it was just totally awesome to have a glow in the dark Ghost Rider skull.
Yeah, just real quick to jump back, those Watchmen covers, and I almost put one on here as well because they're so iconic, but they're so simple. They're iconic because of the story, not the other way around. I think you chose the right one that is just beautiful kind of on its own. My two quick ones, I have an Uncanny, and this one what used to, I used to tell people this is my favorite comic cover of all time, and I did for a really, really long time. And now as a grown up, it doesn't hold as much to me. It was X-Men 31. Not Uncanny, adjectiveless X-Men. It features Spiral, Psylocke, and Revanche, and it's where you start to unlock all of Psylocke's secrets. Not a great storyline. It's an Andy Kubrick piece. The reason I love it is because there's hands and swords everywhere. It's like my brain had re-sort of imagined this as a much more stained glass tarot card piece. And I think if they had done it that way, it would be a much better piece. It's not a bad piece at all. Kubert's a god. But there's nothing but danger going on in this piece. There's just, it's just a miasma of swords. Spiral with her six swords, Revanche with her two, and Psylocke with her two. You ain't walking out from this. These bitches are going to cut you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the other one I have is a series. It's the one I mentioned. It's arguably my favorite Daredevil story of all time. It was called Decalogue, and each one of the covers, a Decalogue, for those who are unknown, and I had to learn, and I learned this, are the Ten Commandments. They're a set of 10 rules, so the Ten Commandments are a Decalogue. Each, since Daredevil has a lot of religious iconography, each one of these is one of the Ten Commandments, and it's Daredevil standing over them. I have a couple of them as t-shirts, and the last one says, hold on one second, I'm loading things as we talk. They're each a different flat color. They're each a different one of the Ten Commandments. And the last one has him standing there in just pure silhouette that just says, I am your God.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I'm looking at it now.
And it's right around the same time where he became the leader of Hell's Kitchen. Where he had taken down the Kingpin. And again, I don't remember entirely whether that's before or after. But a lot of these are variations of other famous Daredevil covers. There's so much thought into them. The Honor Your Mother and Father is from the very iconic, the famous one where he's crying over Karen Page's grave. Or maybe it was Elektra's. We'll get letters. But the Thou Shall Not Kill is also from another cover. Again, brain not working entirely. But yeah, this whole series of covers had me enamored more than the books themselves, and I love the books.
Yeah, it's a very minimalist kind of look to it with that kind of Frankie Goes to Hollywood lettering.
Yeah, big, bold, impact font.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, as when I started, when I was like, oh, my God, I love these covers, Danielle from Wild Pig was like, of course you do. You draw dots and, like, black and white things. I was like, yes, they're perfect. So yeah,
that I Am Your God cover in French is just as imposing.
It is. Je suis ton Dieu.
That's good stuff right there.
So that is our comic covers show for a show where you have to go and Google a lot of things. We hope we kept you entertained. Were we right? Were we wrong? You tell us. Tell us your favorites. We'll post them all over the Facebook and the website and the Twitter. What do you got, sir?
Yeah. For those of you who want to go back, my intent is to get all the comic book covers that we talked about and make sort of an amalgamation image for the picture that we use for this episode on our website. So if you're listening to this through the iTunes or the Stitcher or your favorite podcast catcher of choice, and you would like to see what these comic book covers look like, go to somethingcast.com, and the image for this episode will be a kind of collage slash quilt of the covers that we talked about.
An AIDS quilt of comics, if you will.
It is.
So yeah, past that, again, go please check out the Patreon, patreon.com/somethingsomethingcast. We are trying to build up our little world, and we could use your help. We want to go to conventions. We want to go and get interviews from people. We want to upgrade our tech. All those things take a couple bucks. You get extra stuff. You get live drama. You get full episodes when we sort of ramble when we don't expect to. And yeah, that's what I got.
Yeah, when we talk about wanting to go to conventions and stuff like that, it's not like Hatton and I all sit down and talk about, hey, there's this convention coming up. That would be really cool if we went to. And the next sentence is immediately, and what can we do there for the show?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like we just want you guys to pay our way for us to go to conventions. We want to bring you with us as vicariously as we can in whatever way that we can. So we want to give you bigger shows with more content, more varied content. And if you guys want to help support us in doing that, that makes you all pretty baller.
Word.
So yeah, patreon.com/somethingsomethingcast. Help us out.
And with that being said, I think we got this one in the bag. Thank you guys for sitting and listening. I know it's an extra long one, but we got a shorter one last time. It balances in the wash.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that being said, I'm James Hatton.
I'm Podcast Rob.
We will see you guys next time.
Later.
Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero. He's a looking so cute. Sneaking round in a blue jumpsuit. Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero. He's a blazing away. Like the stars, stars, stars in the universe. Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero. He's a screaming the truth. America, America's killing its youth.